The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian.
And today we have a special podcast. We're going to share with you a conversation that we had with Canada's Natural Resources Minister, the Honorable Seamus O'Regan, on June 22nd. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to a special live stream video session of our ARC Energy Ideas podcast. We've got a lot of registrants from all across the country, really almost overwhelmed by the response. Not only that, we've got members from the United States, as far as even Nigeria and Pakistan. So welcome to all wherever you are. And today, as Jackie mentioned, we're delighted to have a special guest all the way from the wonderful province of Newfoundland and Labrador, the Honorable Seamus O'Regan. He's a graduate of the Cambridge University in the UK. Many of you will know him as a veteran network broadcaster. But importantly, since 2015, he's been a Member of Parliament for St. John's, Newfoundland. And since 2019, he's the Minister of Natural Resources Canada, which oversees our country's energy industry. So welcome with delight, Seamus.
Thank you, Peter, Jackie, and everybody who came. It's late in Pakistan, so this is, thank you for your patience.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I just to start, I'd like to call you Seamus, if you don't mind.
Of course.
I just kind of sort of want to drop the formality. I'm in your home. The audience is in your home there in St. John's. You're in my home.
This is after all a conversation.
No, we're not in the House of Commons. So this is just, fantastic. So thank you to the audience, and thank you to the audience for all the questions. My email, InBin, LinkedIn, you name it, every channel of multimedia, social media, was inundated with questions. I know you too had a lot of questions, Jackie. Well, the questions that we formulated, try to cover as much of them as possible, and we're going to do it in three sections. We're going to talk, first of all, about the Western Canadian oil and gas industry. Then we're going to move on to another important component of our country's energy industry in Newfoundland and Labrador. And finally, we're going to talk about the transition to a lower carbon energy economy going forward into the future. Well, before we get to that agenda, what we want to do is start with a poll. There's going to be three polls throughout the course of this podcast. And the first one, I'm going to pass over to you, Jackie, to ask our audience to do a quick poll just to get the ambiance of the session settled.
Okay, so today we're going to talk a lot about net zero and the prospects for Canada to achieve that, especially around oil and gas. So we want to know your opinion right off the start. Do you think Canada's oil and gas sector can achieve net zero by 2050?
I wanted to vote yes, and then I read the fine print that host and panelists cannot vote.
That's right.
But let it be known.
Numbers.
Jackie, so what do you think?
Almost half the people say yes, but there's some people that are skeptical. 31% say no, and 24% are unsure. Let's, through this conversation, talk about how we could achieve it, and maybe we'll bring some folks into the yes camp.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that is definitely going to be a subject of conversation throughout the three sections. But what we want to do is, frankly, let's just start out the conversation by addressing what we would call the moose in the room here in Canada. That is that, the people in Western Canadian oil industry here, particularly in Alberta, would say that they haven't been feeling a lot of love in the last many years from the federal government, from the rest of the country, in terms of feelings about the oil and gas industry and the future of the oil and gas industry. On the other hand, other Canadians would basically say something like, okay, stop complaining, get on with the future program. We've got to pivot to the new world. And frankly, I sort of listened to all of this, and I've been listening to it for years, and I don't understand how we as a country that are so privileged with so many national resources have allowed ourselves to get into this polarized situation. So Seamus, I'd like to ask you, how did we get here, and how can we get out of this polarized situation?
I just came from the World Economic Forum this morning, Peter. And, this job, when I got into it, talking to my Amarjeet Sohi and Jim Carr before me, they were always off at these very interesting international functions. So I look forward to going to the International Energy Agency meetings and the World Economic Forum. And, of course, I've been doing those meetings, but albeit from my den here. And one of the things I noticed very early on was that I'm always asked to speak. I'm always, if you have an hour and they have ministers from all over the world in energy, I'm always asked to speak. And objectively, it's not because of me, it's because of the country I represent. You know, I'm always, well, we all know there's a hierarchy to Zoom. I'm always on the first page, but it's because of Canada. And it's because Canada is the fourth biggest producer of oil and gas in the world. And it's something that I keep repeating and reiterating at every audience in which I give a speech, because I think it's really important that we embrace that. And I don't think, you know, there are those of us who live in Alberta who are near people who work in the industry or actually see the industry. It's visible to them. Same with Saskatchewan. Certainly clear for me in Newfoundland, because I look out my, you know, I walk maybe two blocks down and I'm in front of supply ships that are heading out every day to rigs. So it's very clear to me, and it's no surprise to me, that we are, I think, the energy superpower that we are. 500,000 people, 8% of the GDP, $122 billion in exports. And it's important that more Canadians embrace that and understand it so that we understand the challenges that are before us, so that we understand that when we say that we're going to get to net zero, we understand what we need to do, that it is not going to be easy. On the other hand, we have the resources, I think, that we're able to do it. I don't blame people when, you know, there's a certain degree of skepticism. Actually, I'm emboldened by the optimism I saw in that poll. Net zero is a moonshot. And a moonshot is not, you know, the same as just throwing ideas out there and seeing what'll stick. A moonshot is a very defined goal, just as Kennedy defined it for the, you know, to get to the moon. And then afterwards, the teams at NASA had to figure out how to do it. And by, you know, by 1969, we had a man on the moon. If we can do that in 8 years, it'd be great. But the important thing is that psychologically we set the goal. I'm very proud of the fact, by the way, that Newfoundland and Labrador is the first, I believe, energy-producing province in the country, and certainly passed a commitment to net zero unanimously in our legislature here only, I think, 2 weeks ago. And I think that bodes really well for the province and for its vision. I'm going to stop there. But
yeah, I think
proximity right. has a lot to do with it, Hugh.
I think it has a lot to do with it. And I think this is a frustrating thing because I travel the world and go to conferences and things, at least pre-COVID. And universally, people look at Canada and its energy industry with pretty much admiration.
Yeah.
And so you're so privileged with the natural resources you have and everything else. Yet we in this country seem to be ripping ourselves apart. And I agree that we can get to that moonshot, and it is a moonshot. But how can we do it without ripping the social fabric of the country apart? Because I just feel really heartbroken almost that we're in this situation across this country where we can't agree on how to go forward with our industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, and you know, you see it reflected in the political spectrum as well. I think that that's fair to say. But you have to keep trying.
Yeah.
Because as you said, our economy relies on this.
Hugely.
Our way of life, our prosperity relies on this. So there's, to a certain degree, you know, I think it's leadership, it's effective communication, it's finding tangible results, it's reminding people that, you know, not only are we the fourth biggest producer of oil, we're also the second biggest provider of hydroelectricity. We're a world leader in a lot of emerging technologies, including solar, including clean tech, including wind, you know, and that recently, having made some investments in inactive and orphan wells. We hit something there on inactive and orphan wells. I mean, with the amount of money that we've provided the governments of Alberta and Saskatchewan and British Columbia, because we concentrated on the workers affected. One of the things I said this morning at the World Economic Forum, amongst, you know, other things, I really wanted to concentrate on inclusion. And as we come to grips with this transition. And let me be clear, this transition, I believe, is inevitable because that's where investment dollars are going. And we're seeing that. We could talk about that a little more. But, you know, you follow the money. That's where investment dollars are going. They're going to jurisdictions that are taking net zero seriously. But in the process of getting there, we have to make sure that people aren't left behind. And I put on the top of that list energy workers and their families.
Yeah.
And then I would also add to that regions like yours and regions like mine cannot be left behind. And in the prospect of the World Economic Forum, I would say countries, because if we don't include people and if they don't feel included in this transition, then they will look for governments and they will elect governments that frankly don't take this as seriously or will pull back. So in a democracy, you need to make sure that you have a critical mass of people if you're going to be able to do this.
Right. Well, we're going to talk more about net zero and the ability to do that here coming up. I'm going to turn it over to Jackie. You're going to talk a little bit about the more recent price crash that we've seen in the industry, which is a whole other dimension of issue.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. And Seamus, thanks for your thoughts. Maybe the net zero is the way to bring people together around energy in Canada, and we'll talk more about it. But let's talk about the oil price crash that we're experiencing right now. And it's been very difficult in Western Canada, even back to 2015. But now we have COVID, which has been devastating to commodity prices. In fact, the amount of rigs operating in Western Canada are at an all-time low ever for the data that we've been, as long as we've been tracking data. So take us through some of the thought processes your government has been discussing as you've been coming up with the various policies that have come out recently, everything from talking with the G20 to stabilize oil prices to the financial help that you've extended to the oil and gas industry.
Thank you, Jackie. From the very beginning, we started talking. Well, I've been talking to CAP since I took the portfolio, and even before then, obviously, because I'm from an oil-producing province. And our conversations became more regular when the lockdown came out. What they told me from the beginning was liquidity was the most important issue. Liquidity, liquidity, liquidity. And so we've attempted to get that out there. We still, I would acknowledge, have some ways to go because we're hearing from people on the ground, that we still have some ways to go. The wage subsidy has been a huge help, I think, to a lot of companies, and not something that they or any of us take for granted. Concentrating on workers, making sure that we hold on to those workers and hold on to those companies so that the workers have a place to go back to work too. It's very important to remember, and I know the governor of the Bank of Canada was talking about this morning, saying it will be a prolonged recovery and it will be bumpy, but we will get there because, it is important to remember that, this is a recession that was self-induced. We asked companies to shut it down for a while, to lock down while we attempted to get through this. And we want to make sure that we come out of it. So, liquidity is incredibly important. That was the thought behind the Orphan Well and an Active Well program, was concentrating on workers, making sure that we didn't lose talent, making sure that these people were able to provide, workers were able to provide for their families and have good, meaningful work. This work takes time, and it takes talent, it takes experience. And so we wanted to lock people. And so dealing with workers was, I think, preeminent in our mind. And also in the interim, making sure that people felt financially secure so that when we needed them to stay in, they stayed in.
And I would just say the wage subsidy was very, very helpful. And a lot of companies have benefited greatly from that. And the extension of that is helpful as well. But Peter, you have some feedback on the loan program, which we've heard of.
Yeah. We've been working and talking with so many people during this pandemic that has affected so many industries, including the oil and gas. We've been talking with your government and other governments, Jackie and I. But, one of the things we're noticing in especially the debt-oriented programs, the loan programs toward the oil and gas industries, there's just not a lot of take-up. Basically, the uptake has been really weak. And so I guess from your perspective, what are you seeing? Can we fix this problem? Because, there's still a lot of hurt and pain, as Jackie mentioned, like the rig count is so low. What are you thinking?
We've been working with BDC and EDC, and they continue to work with private institutions on the ground in Alberta, Saskatchewan, out here in Newfoundland, to make sure that we're getting money to the people that they need to get. We continue to work to try and get it right. We know that there's a number of people out there who just don't want to take on more debt. And look, that's understandable. And these are, individual decisions that are made. But I would tell those people, if you look, there is an overwhelming uptake of people who are going for it, and we've had an overwhelming uptake for Orphan and Inactive Wells. I worked closely with Sonia Savage on this. I remember her telling me a few weeks ago that she was out gardening and somebody came up and approached her saying, "Hey, where's my application?" We've worked very hard on the stabilization of price. And I think with the LEAF program, we've been carefully monitoring the uptake on that, along with EDC and BDC. The rollout of LEAF is somewhat ahead of the rollout for some of the mid-cap programs, which may be leaving some companies waiting to decide, which is best for them to apply.
Yeah, I think it's that mid-cap program, if I may interject, that is the one that targets a lot of companies, because in that mid-cap space, the junior to intermediate space, there's so many companies. And, the lack of uptake, of course, leads to this cynicism that, the federal government designed these programs to fail,
No, and look, mid-cap is just rolling out. It's still early days. Our assessment is that some companies are still doing number crunching. They're still looking into the terms and conditions of various programs. They're seeing what's required. Some of them are doing analysis to, you know, to see if they need bridge financing. And if they do, then they'll apply. I mean, with Leaf, Leaf itself was intended to be a lender of last resort. So companies may still be working with their financial institutions, I think, to see if, you know, they can come up with alternative arrangements. I can't stress enough that the federal government is absolutely committed to supporting Canadian workers and their families. This is the biggest industry in the country. It's our biggest export. So, you know, there's a lot on the line for everybody. I would not allow, in this instance, politics to skew, you know, smart financial, smart economics. The bottom line is the country's not going to recover unless the oil and gas sector recovers.
Yeah, I mean, somebody's got to pay for, it's a big bill for the whole COVID thing. But
bottom line.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I'm sure, a relief for many to hear that you're there to help the industry. And let's hope that those programs get out to the many companies that need them. Let's switch topics to reconciliation. Indigenous engagement is a priority for the Liberal government, and the oil and gas industry is a leading employer of Indigenous people. How can we develop our natural resources and aid in reconciliation?
Acknowledging that it's a priority is first and foremost, that's a big deal. A lot of companies, you know, a lot of our energy extraction industries, whether it be oil and gas or mining, have a lot of experience in dealing with First Nations or Inuit and Métis. And there's a strong history of collaboration. I grew up in Labrador in what was at the time a fly-in, fly-out community. Growing up there, you know, I went to school with Indigenous people, with First Nations people and Inuit and Métis. And they did not have it easy. And it was a big eye-opener for me. So my undergraduate degree, which is in political science, I did my honors thesis on Indigenous protests against development that they didn't want. I worked on the impact benefit agreement on Voisey's Bay, which was in Labrador. I worked very hard on that. Worked on two land claims agreements for the Inuit Nainu in Labrador, and then went on and did my master's on Indigenous participation in natural resource development. It's a big passion of mine, and the portfolio I held before this was in Indigenous services. All that to say, we hit some important milestones over the course of the past year. And I think one of the biggest milestones for me was the TMX decision. The TMX decision gave us a roadmap. First of all, it affirmed that our course correct in dealing and attempting to accommodate with First Nations on the path to TMX was the right one. And the courts, in a unanimous decision, said, you know, you're on the right track. These are the markers you have to follow. That was what we needed to hear. Because ultimately, not only is reconciliation the right thing to do, it is also the smart thing to do, because it will lead to stability and surety and certainty for business. That is why I think there's a vested interest here. And that's why, you know, all parties, I think, you know, come to the table with their own interests. Indigenous groups, First Nations amongst, you know, they all have very different views on development themselves. I've spoken at the Assembly of First Nations, Assembly of Chiefs, and they were shouting on the ground floor amongst chiefs, those who were in favor of development, those who aren't. And even then, you know, development on their individual terms. So whoever you're dealing with, you deal with them with respect, deal with them eye to eye, and you listen to them. And I didn't realize an incredible amount from there.
Yeah, I didn't realize you had that background. And it'll be interesting with TMX to see how this opportunity potentially for equity works out for some of the Indigenous groups. I think that could be a real template for maybe how large infrastructure projects go going forward.
The conclusion I attempted to reach in my master's thesis, and this is 20 years ago, so you'd have to, you know, lots has happened since, is exactly that. I mean, what, you know, is equity preferable to royalties? And frankly, you know, the conclusion, and I had looked at a lot of, looked at examples in Australia and New Zealand at that time, was it really depends on who you're dealing with. And it really depends on you know, sometimes their capacity and their experience in dealing with similar circumstances. Some want equity, some royalties. Depends on who you deal with, and that, you know, that's their decision.
So, yeah, I mean, dealing with, I think that's a great sort of phrase, because I feel like we are dealing in this country, in this industry, with each of the three letters in ESG, environment, the social issues, social Indigenous issues, governance. We're incredibly transparent in our corporate reporting and so on. And so, you know, I want to talk a minute about this almost assault on our country. Like a few minutes ago, I talked about how most of the countries in the world look upon Canada as favorably, but it seems like there's a few that don't. And I'm going to single out Norway, because, you know, like, I don't understand where they're coming from. Like they sort of bashing our companies based on old data, from what I can gather, divesting of Canadian companies. Meanwhile, 300 other companies that they have in their portfolio are scattered all around the world with far less ES and G. I want to ask you, how does your government feel when the Norwegians come out and basically rip our efforts in this country?
How do I feel? So they hit your region in the sense that, you know, they're redirecting investments. They hit my region in that they're competitors. And they are strong competitors. So, you know, for instance, industry here, you know, is really sees the answer in exploration and incentives for exploration. And no wonder, because we're looking at Norway and literally, you know, you have vessels that are on their way over there. Exploration is down everywhere, which is why the Norwegians are also being very aggressive. They've you know, their parliament met in an emergency session, I think, 2 weeks ago, and parties there were falling, you know, over one another, trying to up the amount of exploratory incentives that they were offering. It is very difficult to compete with them. It is a very, very different culture. They seem to, you know, live very comfortably in a space in which they have an extremely strong and vibrant offshore industry that we compete against. And, you know, on the other hand, while they're aggressive on oil, they're hugely aggressive on hydroelectricity, and they're hugely aggressive on foreign aid. They're hugely aggressive on making sure that they're funding the forestation of Brazil. I mean, you know, they're yeah. trying to be good world players, and they live with that dichotomy very comfortably.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess maybe
back
that's
to the beginning of our conversation, where we seem to be pulling each other apart over this. They live with it quite comfortably. It's fascinating to watch them. It's more than fascinating, to be honest with you. I have to keep a very close eye on them because, as I said, they're direct competitors for our offshore.
Yeah.
We went one big step with the completion of our regional assessment here, which means that now we don't have to separate environmental assessments for every exploratory well. It's down, you know, our wait times on this from 905 days before you can drill to 90. That at least puts us in the ballpark with Norway in terms of time. But in terms of incentives, they are operating, and their politics operate in an entirely different space. Yeah. It can be very frustrating.
It is frustrating. And maybe I totally agree with you. I understand competition and communication efforts within competition, and maybe I just need to get over it. So maybe that's what it is, or maybe they're just sore because they landed in Newfoundland. When was it, 1,000 years ago, and they couldn't hack it or something? But anyway, that's a good segue into Newfoundland and Labrador, a province which I certainly love. I've visited many times, and it's no secret that things are tough here out west, but they're really tough out there in the oil and gas industry. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's really tough. And, you know, we have to find some solutions for the industry here because we have, you know, some $6 billion in development that we have seen evaporate, or at least not, shouldn't say evaporate, been put on hold, but it's shaken this province significantly. And the answers that we have found for Alberta and BC and Saskatchewan don't necessarily play here. We've got to find some unique solutions. We have some projects that were midway through, like West White Rose, where you had, I think, some 900 people who were on the construction site building the gravity-based structure for West White Rose. That's Husky. We have Terra Nova, which has been not producing since December. Hibernia has stopped drilling. I mean, they're still producing, but they're not drilling. And it is shaking people here. And you know, certainly I don't, you know, there's a great deal of pressure on the government of Canada, the government of Newfoundland and Labrador to come forward with something that is going to work for the industry here. And it is urgent. As dire as that sounds, I have great faith in the industry when we're competing around the world. And we have an oil that is low in it. You know, the emissions per barrel are, I think, somewhere around 18 kilograms, which makes us extremely competitive for those who are looking for low emission oil. And, you know, there are an increasing number of buyers for that. There are other, you know, Peter, you and I have discussed this. There are some other things that, you know, you kind of, you stand back and you realize what assets they are. Newfoundland is geographically, you know, when you grow up, you look at the map of Canada and Newfoundland always seems to be on the very tail end of it. Well, in fact, if you take a step back, and I got a map in all my offices, actually in Ottawa and St. John's, that's the Newfoundland-centered map. And in it, we're like right in the middle of the G7, I would argue. You know, if you look at geographically where we are between all the major markets of the European Union, and when you look at NAFTA, And when you look over the North Pole and you hit Japan, we are in a pretty good space. And you know, when I lived in Europe for a while as a student and working over there, I worked at INSEAD for a year. I could fly over in 3 hours and 55 minutes from St. John's to Heathrow. St. John's to Toronto is about 3 hours and 45 minutes. We have a great coastline. We have a lot of coastline. That is always a geographic asset. We are, I think, well located. We have great hydroelectric assets, albeit, you know, with Muskrat Falls, the finances behind it are crippling. But in terms of a source of hydroelectricity, low emitting electricity, that's pretty good. And so we got to get our heads around, you know, overcoming the hurdles that are definitely before us and realizing the prospects and the optimism that do lie there that aren't going away. And that is not going to be easy. Trust me,
nor,
I know.
Nor is it short term, right? It's not a short term.
But you know, that's, I'm determined to get there. I'm determined to lay that foundation.
So you mentioned that you're low carbon already. I don't think a lot of people recognize that. I certainly didn't. I wanted to talk a little bit. You mentioned at the beginning that the government has just passed a net zero law. And I found it interesting this was passed the end of May or early June, even with the type of economic uncertainty that we have right now. Just give us a little bit of background on that. And was the oil and gas industry there receptive to that change?
Yes, they were, because they realized what an asset they have in low emitting oil. And so this is a great way to highlight that asset. So, you know, I think they recognize that the government of Canada was committed to it. I spoke at GLOBE, which, you know, many of your audience knows is the biggest clean tech conference in North America, in Vancouver. And, you know, when I got up there, I said, you know, everybody has to understand and appreciate that we will never get to net zero without Alberta. We will never get to net zero without Saskatchewan or Newfoundland and Labrador. And in effect, we will not get to net zero without the oil and gas industry. It's our number one export. It's our biggest business. Like, we will never get there unless we tackle that head on. You know, I wouldn't say it was necessarily the line that everybody there wanted to hear, but they realized, yeah, that's the truth. And the next day, I flew to Calgary, and Sonia Savage and I were co-hosting an Oil and Gas Innovation Summit. And there's some, you know, there were major players there, many of whom I'm sure are on this. And what I realized as we were talking, and it was shortly after BlackRock had, you know, had made its decision to really focus on jurisdictions that were focusing on net zero. They were staying away from Canadian oil and gas. This was starting to sink in. And, you know, and I said, look, on the flip side of what I had said at GLOBE, the oil and gas industry needs net zero. Because the danger, I think, for our industry in this country is that whether they're in Zurich or whether they're in London or whether they're in New York, if you've got a portfolio manager sitting at the end of a boardroom table and just saying, what are we doing about net zero? What are we doing about climate change? What are we doing with the climate crisis? And somebody could just put up their hand and say, oh, we're not buying Canadian oil. We're not investing in Canadian oil. And a box is checked. You do not want to become the box to check. That's the scary thing. And so what I said was, what is increasingly becoming the box to check on the other side of the ledger for a lot of investment firms is net zero. That is now sinking in as kind of